right, I think we're almost there.
Okay.
And probably we're there now. Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. It's Angie Atkinson, and I'm here with the lovely and talented Dana Morningstar. Dana, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be back.
Always happy to have you. Today, we are back for our regular Tuesday live stream, which we try to do every Tuesday, and we alternate channels between this channel and Dana's channel, which is called Thrive After Abuse, here on YouTube. There I go. I got myself muted. And she's also at thriveafterabuse.com and Thrive After Abuse on Facebook, Twitter, etc.
Yeah.
So yeah, be sure that you subscribe to both channels so that you can be notified if you want to come to these live streams on Tuesdays. You can also text Angie Live, all one word, A-N-G-I-E Live, to 33222, or Dana Live, all one word, D-A-N-A Live. Dana, what's your number again? 22999?
Yep, that's Woo! The one.
All right. I'm good at numbers sometimes. Okay. Good, good. All right. So we thought that today we would start off by talking about this article I found on Psychology Today. Actually, you heard about it on TikTok this morning.
Okay.
Yeah. And it was written by this Aaron Leonard, PhD, who does the Peaceful Parenting column at Psychology Today. And the article is about the one thing a narcissist and a people pleaser have in common. I'm not going to read you the whole article, but basically what it comes down to is something we've talked about quite often on both my channel and Dana's channel, which is the fact that very often a narcissist and a person involved with a narcissist who is maybe a codependent or who may be a people pleaser, they often come from the same type of background, meaning they had experienced similar trauma in childhood, whether they were neglected or ignored, abused. They had some kind of trauma growing up. Dana, what are your thoughts about that?
I think that it's very spot on. It's interesting how you can have two people go through the same experience or a very similar experience and come out at such opposite ends of the spectrum.
Mm. Yes, it really, really. And I think what I've seen, and, you know, I've done a lot of research on this topic myself. And one of the things that I see is a lot of times it's the way that whether you become a narcissist or a people pleaser usually is a result of how you personally internalize and process what happens to you while it's happening and after. Would you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even on a lesser extent, kind of just how the hard wiring of a person, which defense mechanism kind of kicks in. If there's more of that fight defense, which is the basis for narcissism, or if it's more of that quote unquote friend defense that results in that ingratiating behavior.
Mm-hmm. And I've seen also like people who go with the freeze. I think those are more serious trauma, but that's probably not a topic of today. But I think you're right. I think for me personally, I've started to realize pretty early that, look, if I act this way, then people are not, you know, the people in my family were nicer to me. But if I acted like myself, not so much. So I don't know. But I also, the people pleaser behavior certainly was one that I dealt with myself. I was constantly trying to walk on eggshells around literally everyone by the time I became an adult. And it seemed really important to me that, you know, that I was liked by other people, and that took a while to get over. And I think I just only recently could say that I'm fully over it. Cause at some point, you know, I don't know if it's cause I'm older or just all of the work I've done to get to this point. But at some point you just have to realize that, you know, no matter how much you do for some people, they will never appreciate you. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter how little you do for other people, they'll always appreciate you. So it's an interesting conundrum, I think, that comes up.
Yeah. I remember the first time I noticed kind of the similarities was actually with two dogs that I used to have years ago. This is 10, 15 years ago. I had adopted two dogs from the pound.
Yeah.
Okay? Both had been, you know, had issues that a lot of shelter animals tend to have, and they were at such opposite ends of the spectrum. So one was kind of very antisocial, very aggressive, really not like your typical dog, didn't really like people, ran very hot and cold. You kind of never knew, you'd be very delicate with how to approach him. He'd become very aggressive very quickly. The other dog was the exact opposite. She was very ingratiating, had absolutely no boundaries, no ability for self-protection, would instantly become best friends with anybody that walked in the door. She'd roll over, you know, exposing her stomach. She was absolutely just the sweetest dog you could ever imagine. But at either end of that spectrum, there were issues there. And I remember at the time thinking, oh, this is so weird. They both went through very similar issues, but they turned out so differently. And kind of why is that? And
it's very, it is very interesting. And it's interesting, especially because, you know, we know that dogs are probably a lot smarter than most of us realize they are, right? You've seen those dogs that can do the talking boards, have you?
No. Oh, no. Did they, is that a thing? I used to joke that I needed one of those.
It's the coolest thing I've ever seen. I don't even have dogs. I have cats and they're just like, no, but dogs, it's amazing. They really do. They, you Google it later, watch the dogs talking boards. It's really cool. Anyway, hi Judy. Thank you. Yes. Anyway, so I do, I think it's one of those, I was going to say about the dogs. I think it's really interesting that a dog would have such a, that two dogs would have similar reactions to trauma as humans might have. Right. Yeah. I mean, that's very telling in so many ways. We could get really deep about that, but we won't today. We'll stick to our topic.
Yeah.
You know, but I certainly do think that there is a tremendous amount of, I would say that probably without getting counseling, without getting some kind of like intervention, I would say that anybody who grows up with trauma would go one of those two ways, or some version of that. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to jump into the chat here? I'm looking, I'm seeing a lot of good comments coming through. Let's see.
I don't know. Sure. Here's one from Lori who says, okay. I tried being myself 2 days ago, ended up in a crying breakdown because my narcissist doesn't think I need counseling. He says, get over it. Forgive me and get over it. Ugh.
Lori, tell us in the chat what you need to forgive him for, if you don't mind. But I'm guessing if you feel that you need counseling, that you do. And right. And I think that what I see a lot of times, in fact, I just talked about this earlier on a different platform today, is that whenever you have a problem, the narcissist minimizes your problem. I saw this growing up. I saw this in my marriage, all of this. And whenever they have a problem, the world's about to end. On top of that, I can't tell you how many times I was told, why are you bringing up the past? 15 minutes ago is the past, you know, and that's just not, you know, get over it quickly is one of the common things I hear. What about you? Did you have any experiences similar to that?
Oh yes. Oh yes. And the reality is when a person is running low on empathy, okay, and that's even assuming that that ability to have empathy is even there. If a person's low on empathy and they're not on the receiving end of hurtful behavior, they don't see that it's a big deal, because to them it's not. Right. So it's kind of like the old adage goes, the axe forgets, but the tree remembers.
Ooh.
And so hurtful words, you know, and I think we've all been on both sides of this, saying something that is said in out of frustration or anger, or just even landed the wrong way. Maybe our intentions were good and it just landed the wrong way. It can be easy to justify hurtful or harmful behavior if we're not on the receiving end of it. Thinking, oh, well, you know, oh, I'm sorry, I was really frustrated, I didn't mean that. Or, you know, oh, I didn't mean that to be hurtful. And if a person's carrying around that hurt, it can seem like, well, gosh, kind of, you know, get over it. But then hopefully the more we emotionally mature, we realize that, you know, if what we did or said, or what was said and done is hurtful, that that's not for us to say, to deny another person's experience and say, oh, you just need to get over it, or oh, that wasn't that bad, or oh, that wasn't that hurtful, or other people have experienced worse. Or like in Lori's situation, telling them, I don't think you need counseling. Mm-hmm. You know? Well, that frankly, that opinion is irrelevant.
That's if, right. If
you, Lori, think that you need counseling or any type of support or resources, then you're the one to make that decision. Thankfully, you know, we don't need to look to other people to take a vote on what we do. Yeah. So they don't have to be in agreement. Right. As a friend of mine once said, people have a voice, but they don't have a vote.
Right. That's yeah. right. Yeah. Now here's something interesting. Lori says, I remember I asked her to let us know in the chat.
About, yeah.
Yeah. She said, I'm 55 and I never had any counseling ever. And he did a lot of rotten things in our 20-year relationship. So now he thinks since he's holding a job down and not using drugs, he's okay. You know what? this is kind of interesting because right before we started this session, we were trying to decide between this topic and the topic of what narcissists and alcoholics have in common. And the reason I bring that up is because I see this a lot. What I've seen, and Dana, tell me if you've seen something different, is when you have a person in active addiction, whether or not they are a narcissist, like IRL in real life, they act like a narcissist if they're in active addiction, because they, instead of focusing on, you know, supply from a person, they're focusing on supply from a drug. So they're always focused on what can I get? How can I get the drug? How can I use the drug? How can I obtain the drug? You know, where can I get money to buy the drug, whatever. But in that process of being focused so hard on the drug, they're not focused on what their people in their life need. And they're not focused on empathy. They have none, because all they care about is the drug, right? Well, it's a similar thing with a narcissist with a supply, but in this case, and I see this a lot, sometimes you'll see somebody who is acting just like a narcissist and they're in active addiction, and then they go into recovery and they look back at what they've done and who they've been. And they're like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. I had no idea. And they mean it and they change. Right. But then you've got the ones who go through recovery and they get in the program and they do the thing and they're all into it, but then they don't change. They're still a narcissist. And, you know, Lori, I'm not going to tell you what to do with your life, because 20 years is a long time. But at this point, none of us are getting any younger. And if this man has done no changing, do what you got to do. I'm just saying, be careful. But maybe you should join one of the groups like, Al-Anon or Nar-Anon, or I don't know, that's not Nar-Anon. Well, anyway, I know Al-Anon is the one that's for the family, right, Dana?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I know that might be somewhat helpful for you to hear what other people are going through in a similar situation with addiction and stuff. But I mean, with having dealt with an addicted person, but outside of that, I think maybe it's time for you to start thinking about putting yourself first, maybe for the first time. Dana, mm-hmm. I would love to hear your thoughts on this for Lori.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, one of the challenges with addiction is you're not sharing the same reality, because that person, if they're, especially if they're using some sort of mind altering substance, whether it be drugs or alcohol, they're not there. So they're very, very deeply unaware of all of the pain and suffering their behavior has caused. Yeah. And so even if they work the 12 steps, there is some sort of acknowledgement of, yeah, okay, I can see certain things. You know, it's yeah. maybe really destroyed my marriage, or I've lost a bunch of jobs, or, you know, there's this pattern of really painful consequences, mm-hmm. but moment to moment of all of the emotional pain in between those consequences, they weren't present for that. They were drunk or high.
Right.
So, you know, that's a big part of it. But like Angie was saying, you know, a person can also have, there can be the addiction, and then there can also be a personality disorder on top of that. And even if there isn't a full out personality disorder, oftentimes emotional immaturity and addiction runs hand in hand. Again, when a person is not in reality, they're also not growing and learning and introspective. They're numbing out to reality. So there's kind of this, I don't know, I guess, saying or concept that when a person starts abusing a substance, that's that point in time where they stop they become emotionally stunted at about that age. So there's a lot of catching up a person has to do once they achieve sobriety. Yeah. Within Absolutely. Terms of how they relate to other people and a whole host of other things.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what I want to add, I don't even know if add, but point out is, mm-hmm. is that The sobriety factor, I had in college, my best friend realized she was an alcoholic. And so she went through this whole recovery process while we were roommates, at least the beginning of it. And it was ugly, but she got through it. And I was there with her getting through it with her. I mean, I wasn't going through it myself, but I was next to her while she was, and I was trying to support her as much as I could. And it was a hard process, and it was not pretty. And at one point, you know, she, there was a lot of drama, but she wasn't a narcissist in real life. And so, you know, when, once she got through the addiction part, once she got through that, that first probably 3 to 5 months, things settled down a little bit. So, I mean, if he's just recently sober, then, you know, maybe give him a minute, but if he's not, you know, do what you have to do. I'm not going to tell you what to do, but you know what to do. If you're going to be stuck in that relationship, I don't know, Dana, any other thoughts? Yeah. Or, yeah.
Well, and at the end of the day, the kind of the part of recovery that families and those in the inner circle of somebody struggling with addiction is the work that we have to do is boundaries. Boundaries, boundaries, boundaries. And that can kind of feel and kind of be like pulling a string on a sweater, because it's not just boundaries. It starts there, but it also involves self-love, self-worth, self-esteem, assertiveness, you know, saying no, recognizing our own wants and needs and thoughts and feelings, and being able to get grounded in that make decisions for ourselves, not looking to other people to agree with us or necessarily to even be supportive. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're at the place where like, you know what, this is what I need. Yeah. You know what, this behavior, I stuck around. This was really painful for a long time. I've got a lot of pent up emotions that I need to explore and process. And, you know, you don't see that, and that is what that is, but yeah, I'm not going to argue with you. I don't need your permission or your validation. Like this is something that I need to do for my healing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, yes, absolutely. Yeah. I want to say really quickly, thank you to Jack Lumen and Helpful Mom for being here and doing your awesome admin thing. And hi, Ted Berry. Hi. He's somebody that comments on my videos a lot. I've been friends with him on Twitter for a long time. Anyway. Okay. We have some really Jill and BB and Melissa and Mikey. Hello, everybody. Okay. So somebody asked, how do you know you're not the narcissist? And we've had some good answers from people. Ted Berry said, you actually experience real empathy. Totally valid. That's a good point. Someone else said, and I think it was Mikey who said it has to do with, even the fact that they asked that question kind of proves it, which in a way it kind of does, unless somebody directly said to you, you're a narcissist. And in which case then you might have questions, but then you roll back to that whole, I actually experience empathy thing. And not only do I experience empathy, but I act from that perspective. So what I mean by that is if you walk down the street and you see a little girl sitting on the side of the street crying, do you walk by and kick dirt in her face, or do you check on her and make sure she's okay? You know,
yeah.
That, which is a dramatic example, of course, but and probably not one that would. Anyway, any other thoughts on? Oh, and wait, one more thing. Mikey said people with empathy and a care for others will ask themselves and other people if they are the narcissist, not for themselves, but to not hurt the people that are around them. And I think that's spot on. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah, it's that. You know, is there room for relationships with other people in your life? You know, is there care and concern about others in general, or is everything that you do self-serving? Is there an inability to introspect? Do you think everything that you do is perfect and right? Do you have kind of this smug superior attitude? Is there just ongoing defensiveness, kind of an inability to take criticism? These traits are all problematic. When some people are afraid that they're the narcissist, oftentimes it can kind of help to back up a little bit and explore, okay, well, they might be talking about these kind of maladaptive learned behaviors or imbalances within their own personality that, and some of it might be on that defensive, problematic, narcissistic end of the spectrum. But examining, oh, okay, are there some things that you're doing that are hurtful or harmful? I think as we go through this process towards healing and self-examination, we'll find, here's a handful of personality traits that we all have. They're all different, but what we all have that are out of balance and they're causing problems in our life. So the good news is if there's a sincere desire to do the work and look inward and see, okay, are there things that I'm doing that are a problem? And what are they? So that awareness is always the first step. And then the sincere desire to actually do the work required to balance out those imbalances.
Yeah.
100%. So just, I guess point being, just because you're not necessarily, you know, just because a person's not a narcissist doesn't mean that they don't have problematic behavior.
Absolutely.
What truth. I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, somebody mentioned fleas in the chat, and that's kind of a term that we've made up in this community. And I mean, not just us, but in the wider narcissistic abuse recovery community. And I know, you know, Dana, you referred to it as something, learned behaviors or something, traits, something just a minute ago, but that's, I thought right then, oh, please. Mm-hmm. what it means is that, you know, when you live with somebody for a long time, just like when you go to a different part of the country and you stay there for a while, then you pick up the accent, you don't notice as much, or a different part of the world sometimes. Mm-hmm. It's the same thing. I think you just, when you live with someone, you pick up habits. I noticed in my case, I picked up certain ways of addressing people where, you know, my ex would address them aggressively. Not everyone, just people he knew really well, you know, oh, you think that's how it's going to be, blah, blah, blah. And it's terrible, but I kind of picked that up for a minute. And I recognized me, you know, doing it to someone one day, someone in my family. And I said, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to do that. This, you know, and I rolled back and changed my behavior at that point. And I think that's another difference between us and them, so to speak, is that if they notice it, they probably won't notice it. But if they do notice it, it will only be because someone brought it up to them, and then they'll just be offended that you said that. And then you'll have to apologize for noticing and pretend you mm-hmm. didn't notice and it was all you, and it's a whole thing. But and there are probably many other things I could think of. Like, I thought when I married my current husband that I would be the one to choose all the decor in the house. And I couldn't believe he thought he got to have a say-so in it because mm-hmm. growing up, I saw my mother do all that. She was the boss of all the things in the house. And so I thought that's how it was. And that's a silly thing to say, but it really happened. So, mm-hmm. You know, so I had to sort of refigure out the world from a perspective of almost being, you know, almost blind in a way, but not really, but like almost unclear about personal relationships. It took a while. Mm-hmm. So yeah. But I think back to what Ted said, number one, the first thing, you know, and when we talk about empathy, there are three types. There's the cognitive, where you understand logically how a person feels or how they might feel. And then there's, you know, compassionate and emotional empathy, where you feel it and you behave in such a way that shows that you feel that. And that's the type of empathy that Ted was talking about when he said you experience genuine empathy. You actually care about how someone feels and you mm-hmm. act from that perspective. So mm-hmm. yes. Okay. Do you have oh, wait a minute. We had a question or a comment from last week you wanted to bring up. What was that one?
Oh, sure. Yeah, there was a question. I think it was from Angela, who says, my ex keeps making me break up with him over and over. It's so stressful.
And I, when we talked about this before, I said, well, what was the, you know, is he coming back and then you're having to push him away again? Is he just refusing to accept the breakup? How's that working? So we don't know the answers to that, but assuming that he's either refusing to accept it or he keeps hoovering her back in, I mean, I think it's clear that the best way to deal with something like that would be no contact or low contact. But I know that's always easier said than done. I'm not sure if there are kids involved. But what are your thoughts about it?
Yeah. I think to me that the question really shows kind of where she's placing her power, which is outside of herself.
Yes.
So regardless of your ex's behavior, at the end of the day, you're the one that gets to choose what relationships you're in and for how long mm-hmm. and when they end. So if this relationship is continually has this longstanding pattern of this is not working, this is chaotic, this is stressful and exhausting, then it's going to be up to you to be like, okay, enough is enough. I'm done. and to set boundaries around that instead of hoping his behavior will change, trying to talk sense in him, twisting yourself into a pretzel, trying to make things work. So part of boundaries is realizing I have to value my own time, my own energy, my own emotions, and put a stop to this kind of stuff, because boundaryless people won't.
Yeah, that's right. They'll suck you dry if they can.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, and back kind of back to, or tying into what you were saying too, about having a narcissistic mother and kind of some of the, you know, problematic thinking that you picked up along the way, and that connection to how we were raised, to kind of the relationships we continue in life. Yolanda here in the chat made the comment. She says, I was with my narcissist for 14 years and found that my mother is my first narcissist.
Same girl. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. I get that. And that's more common than you think. It's kind of interesting the way you figure it out. See, in my case, I didn't figure it out until I realized my mother was one when I was 35 years old. But until then, I just figured out I was the problem. I figured I was the one that, you know, I was obviously the common denominator in my relationships. And so it must be me. And I think a lot of us think that, but we don't recognize that we're letting toxic people tell us who we are. And it started so early in our lives that a lot of us didn't even know that we could be anything else, you know? So I think, it's part of why we do what we do.
Yeah, those early relationships really kind of set the stage for how the roles that we play in future relationships and the dynamics that are created and how we respond to it. So if we grew up in a home where we weren't allowed to have boundaries, or we were continually shamed or abused in any way, shape, or form, or even neglected, then those kinds of behaviors there's a very good chance that that's not going to register as a problem. Right. So as adults, if we find other people that treat us in similar ways, there isn't this level of recognition of, oh, this is a problem, I should leave, or I don't want this in my life. We might find ourselves slipping back into that childhood role of being a people pleaser, trying to fix them, trying to smooth things over, feeling that we need to just stay in this dynamic because commitments forever or whatever other messages that are kind of guiding our behavior. But the problem with those kind of messages is if it's in that unhealthy context of a very destructive relationship, staying committed to somebody while they're dragging you through hell or deeply mistreating you, there's no benefit to that. So, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, and Lori Ray Morris, the one that we talked to earlier, she noted he's afraid I will change, I think, regarding the counseling thing, why he doesn't want to go to counseling. And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that's true. So, you know, what I would do if you need to say whatever you need to say to soothe him into letting you go, do it. Just pretend I'm not going to change. I just want to feel a little better. You know, hopefully you are able to get strength through that. But if he feels less threatened by it, then maybe he would be more likely to permit it, even though I do not think you should allow anyone to tell you what you can and cannot do. But I know how it is. Trust me, I've been there. So yeah. Okay. Let's see. Okay.
Here's a comment from Ted who says, I broke up every 2 to 3 months. You know, you never get used to it, but crave that makeup high.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. Sorry, I'm getting a text from my kid saying that. Sorry, I didn't mean to, but she's saying, anyway, it doesn't matter. Okay. At school. So I'm just going to, going to text. Thank you. Sure. Sorry.
Yeah. And Ted, the challenge with the lows of the lows of an abusive relationship or toxic relationship, and then the highs, the relief of the good times, or you get a text back, or they reopen communication, and it's that huge relief of, okay, this relationship's going to continue. Now everything's going to be okay. The emotional intensity that tends to go with those high moments is often mistaken as love. And this is one of the challenges for people that do get out of abusive relationships, is a healthy relationship doesn't have extreme highs and lows like that. And so they can feel, a healthy relationship can feel very boring. It can feel flat and lacking passion. And that's a problem. And that's another reason people tend to kind of get drawn into the intensity of kind of very volatile personalities. So that's part of some of the work that we have to do with getting clear on what healthy love really looks like, and then finding excitement in other healthy ways, not excitement from the highs and lows of a relationship.
Yes. Sorry about that. Yes, I totally agree with that. I see one from Get Into the Groove, who says, even though I had a major medical incident that affects me every day, my mom still tells me she knows people who have it worse. Yeah, that's it. Did you already read that one and I just reread it?
No.
Okay, good. Okay, sorry. By the way, I just want to sidetrack and say, I know I mentioned this before, but you look really pretty today. I think your skin is glowing or something. Anyway.
Oh, well, thank you.
Yes. Okay. What I wanted to say about that is that is something, even though I had a major medical incident that affects me every day, my mom still tells me she knows people who have it worse. And what that is number one, minimizing a genuine issue that you have, which again is very common. And in fact, I just posted a TikTok this morning, I think, about a toxic relationship red flag. And this is one of it. This is it. They will minimize any illness you have, any other major issues you have, and of course maximize their own. So if she stubbed her toe, that would somehow be worse than whatever you're dealing with, I'm sure. But I just want you to remember that it's not, I hope you don't live with her. And if you do, I'm sorry. But it certainly is a very common narcissist behavior. So any mm-hmm. thoughts?
Yeah. You know, and it can be helpful to kind of realize who are the supportive people in your life and who are not. And for those that aren't supportive, that do default into that diminishing and validating and minimizing kind of behavior, to realize that that's what it is. It's diminishing and invalidating and minimizing, and that you don't need to kind of absorb that and see your experience through their eyes. Because to say, oh, well, yeah, other people have it worse. Okay, well, that might be true, but that doesn't diminish your pain. It's sort of like, okay, if you have a broken ankle, saying that that's somehow not a problem because somebody else has a broken leg.
Right.
Like, no, yeah. Your pain is your pain. And we all feel things according to our pain, not according to somebody else's pain.
So your
broken ankle still hurts.
Yeah.
Just like a broken leg hurts.
Absolutely. And you know, what's interesting about that is that, you know, I hear people, well, let me just put it to you like this. I've had to justify with my kids, you know, they'll say things about, and not so much today, but a couple of years ago, a year ago, maybe one of my kids said to me, you know, I don't even know why you should complain. I know your childhood was really hard and you're really good and da, 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 you know? And so I shouldn't even be sad about whatever they were sad about. And I said exactly what you just said, you know, it's not, you can't compare any your experience to anyone else's experience. Everyone's experience is individual, whether it's physically or psychologically or whatever pain you're experiencing, it is your pain and it's real. And I think for me anyway, I know that any kind of pain I experienced growing up was certainly minimized. Any sort of illness I had was, but luckily, knock on wood, I've been pretty healthy. So I'll just leave it at that. But it certainly is it's common. Yeah.
Yeah. And kind of like I was saying before, when you receive a message like that from another person, you still get to determine how you interpret that.
Yes.
So you can shift the interpretation from, oh, they're right, they don't care, my pain isn't that valid, to they don't understand, this is a reflection of their limitation.
Yes.
Of their empathy and understanding, and decide to not own or absorb that diminishment of their message.
Right.
Making that shift can be very powerful. So being able to see kind of emotionally immature or disempowering or unsupportive behavior for what it is, mm-hmm. and then to kind of disconnect from it, it helps tremendously.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Oh, Dawn notes, and I'm going to bring this up. Normally I don't do things like that, but Dawn says, I wanted to make others dealing with narcissist abuse aware of the miniseries on HBO Max called The Undoing. The topic is being brought to the mainstream. Actually, I have that on my watch list. And now that you said it, I'm going to make sure I watch it. Have mm-hmm. you seen it yet, Dana?
I have. I watched it a few weeks ago.
Did you like it?
It's great. And this is more on, I would say, like the sociopath side of the spectrum, mm-hmm. but yeah, great, great.
Awesome.
Show.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So everybody check that out. Maybe see if you see too much that looks familiar, you can stop doubting yourself. Let's see. BB says some change and are apologetic and apologize. Some do not and never will. So generally, if they are genuine and apologize and they change, they are not a narcissist in my experience. I've not seen a narcissist ever, or anyone who I would consider to have those traits and to lack empathy, which I think is the biggest red flag. I've never seen them change permanently. I've certainly seen short-term changes a couple of times because, well, I want it. I want what I want. So I'm going to do whatever I have to do to get that thing. But so, for example, if you leave a person and they really want you because you're a good source of supply or because you look good on their arm or because you have money or whatever it is, then they'll do whatever that, you know, they need to do to get back in. And that includes fake changing.
Yeah.
But they don't actually stick with it. Once they know that you're fully enmeshed again and you're, you know, it's going to be hard for you to get out really easily, they're going back to their old behaviors like always. That's what will happen. But any thoughts on that, Dana?
Yeah. And this is where deal breakers really come into play. And I see a lot of people, and I was there myself, where the focus is on the problematic behavior. Let's say, for example, cheating. Okay, this person cheated. Then if they start, acting the part of, oh, I'm so sorry, I don't want to hurt you, I don't want to ever do this again, da, da, da. The stopping cheating is only part of the work that needs to be done in order for that relationship to get back on track. Mm. It's the rebuilding of trust. It's their ability. It's their willingness to live a life of transparency. It's, so many things. And sometimes you won't ever know. People tend to get really good at hiding what they're up to. So this is where it kind of is back in your court of, and I would encourage you to focus on the other behavior surrounding infidelity, such as the trust, do they have effective communication? Are they solutions oriented? Are they willing to live a life of transparency? You know, these kinds of things. If those aren't in place, then there still is no relationship present, even if they stop cheating or yeah. stop doing stealing or whatever else they're doing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. I would agree. Do you have any a chat question for us?
I do.
Okay.
Here's one from UK Lady who says, I have a question. What if a person claims to have Asperger's instead of narcissistic personality disorder, but still has the behaviors of somebody with borderline personality disorder? Do they overlap at all?
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to start really quick because I know you have probably more okay. thoughts on this.
Okay.
My experience has been that NPD and Asperger's might look similar from the outside sometimes, but they're not the same. They're very different in where the person's coming from, right? Somebody with NPD is a personality disorder. Asperger's, Dana,
it's cognitive.
Neurological. Okay. Mm-hmm. Cognitive. Okay. So it's different. And then Asperger's, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, is not a result of trauma. It's something else. Accurate or not?
Correct. It's more of a developmental.
Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. And from my understanding of talking to people who have Asperger's, even though they can't always show empathy, they feel empathy. And that's a big difference. I will let Dana take it from there.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts?
I guess here's been my professional experience working with people that have been on the autism spectrum is, and I've worked with many, but probably hundreds over the years. I have yet to meet one that hasn't gone through, I mean, has taken great strides to try to have empathy and to care about others and kind of want to fit in. And so with more autism spectrum disorders, it tends, there might be challenges with relating to people or kind of this level of aloofness, but there isn't this malicious disregard for the rights of other people. This isn't to say that a person can't have a developmental disorder or cognitive issue as well as a personality disorder. They absolutely can. So you can have multiple things going on there, but really not even in the same zip code. Truly.
Yeah. And I know we have people in our community. I don't know if they're here today or not. I think I don't want to call anybody out, but I know we have people in our community who have been diagnosed with Asperger's and who have sort of helped my perspective to be a little clearer on this. Not that I ever thought that people with Asperger's had NPD, but to help me sort of clarify my understanding of why they're different and how they're different. So if anyone is here right now and would like to comment on that in the chat, we'd be happy to see that as well.
Right. There isn't that level of like defensiveness and kind of inability to take criticism or to be wrong, or there isn't like those ego defenses that rise up. It's just more of a kind of that level of disconnection from others, where kind of social norms and body language, kind of social cues tend to be challenging. So very different. In terms of this person has behaviors of somebody with borderline personality disorder, I guess it depends on what behaviors we're talking about. I mean, there's quite a few different traits with borderline personality. And here's the thing too, is a person can have, again, they don't need to have a full out personality disorder. They can have traits.
Yes.
But, and I like to think of traits as imbalances. So if a person has some sort of problematic imbalances or problematic traits, they're still a problem. Regardless of whether or not there's an official diagnosis in place. So at the end of the day, in terms of, so while all of this might be very interesting in terms of who you're letting into your inner circle, frankly, it's kind of irrelevant because your boundaries, standards, and deal breakers are still there.
Yes.
So there's still that expectation of, okay, I expect to be treated with dignity and respect. And I expect, this is kind of the dynamic that I'm looking for people that I date or whatnot. And, it is what it is. That's regardless of whether that a person had a bad day, a bad childhood, they've got other issues going on. If something does not work for you, if this is an exhausting, crazy-making, frustrating, kind of boundary-busting dynamic that you have, diagnosis or not, if it's not working for you, it's not working for you.
That's it.
You don't have to just stay there and think, oh, I should just be more compassionate, because this person had a bad childhood or because of this or that and the other. It's that might sound terrible to say, right? It kind of sounds like, oh, well, geez, Dana, that sounds like you're kind of lacking empathy or that you're not compassionate. But we can't fix other people. And so it's almost not fair to be like, okay, well, these are the standards that I really have for how I expect to be treated. And this is what I'm looking for in a relationship. I'll try to make it work with this other person. But then the whole time we're trying to kind of sand down their rough edges. It's a lot of work for us and it's annoying to them.
Yeah.
So
no doubt.
Yeah. Know your limits and kind of know when to drive on.
Yeah. And I totally agree. I one thing you said to me that really stuck out in my head personally in that situation, in that last couple of sentences, was about we can't fix them. Because I don't know about you, but I can honestly tell you probably every person I've ever dated or been married to I've always thought I can help that person. that person's not secure enough in themselves. I can help them. That person has this right. You know, I would always feel sorry for them with whatever psychological issues they had. And of course, I couldn't see the NPD or whatever you want to call it, the narcissistic traits, the toxicity at first, or I did see it, but I thought I could help them. And you're absolutely right in that I learned it the very hard way, as did you, I'm sure. You can't fix someone who doesn't want to be fixed, and you can't fix someone else. You can only fix yourself. You can certainly help someone, you know, but like Dana and I, we can't reach out through the chat and fix you personally unless you personally want to do something to feel better and be better. You know, we can say the most profound or not, the most profound things ever or not. Mm-hmm. And if something strikes home with you, you can feel it deeply and you can either change or grow, or you cannot. It's totally your choice. You know that. But we sometimes, especially people who consider themselves empaths, we very often can help other people do better, right? We can help people, but we can't help someone who doesn't want help. And a narcissist almost never thinks they want help. They just don't want help with changing their personality. They want you to help them with their laundry and their cooking and their cleaning and their bills and whatever else, but not actually with this, you know?
Yeah. So. And the challenge too is sometimes you might come across some very, highly manipulative, very insightful toxic people that will say, oh, I need you. I want to change. I need you to help me change. This is a boundary issue too. So knowing what is ours to fix and what is not ours to fix. So even if they want to change, it is not your responsibility to carry them across the finish line. Nor is it appropriate, nor does it work.
Right. And what is it you always say? You have this idea. I love when you say this, not the squirrely, but I do love it too. but one of the things you always talk about is, okay, if you really believe that they're going to change, you tell them 5 years. What is it? Talk to me about that really quick. The 5 years thing with counseling. You say, they say they're going to get counseling. They're going to change. They're going to do all this stuff. You start to see the changes. You start to doubt yourself. And then you said to tell them, okay, 5 years, let's stay apart for...
Well, change is a process, right? For any of us. And wanting to change is not enough, because we all want.
Right.
So the only change is actual change, is sustained change. And that's a process. The challenge with so much, you know, buckets full of very dysfunctional behavior and severe, profound emotional immaturity, you're not just talking about one thing. It's not just, oh, I need to get this person to stop yelling at me. The fact that another adult thinks it's somehow okay to belittle, berate, scream, yell, spit, kick, you know, act like a kindergartner, a really problematic kindergartner in public or to even in private, that's a lot. So you've got to really think, okay, there's a lot of skills that they need to unlearn and then a whole bunch more that they need to learn. And that's a process that does not happen over time. It does not. And here's the thing too, with therapy, most people tend to maybe go to like 7 sessions and that doesn't get a person very far. Mm-mm. So when it comes to learning too, there's this cognitive awareness, kind of these aha moments of, oh, wow, let me identify now. This is the problem. This is hopefully within themselves. Right. It's such a long process. So most people in terms of relation, when there's a problematic relationship, they get into therapy to talk about the other person. Mm-hmm. Here's everything I'm experiencing. Here's everything that's ever that people have done to me. And they're focused on processing that anger and that hurt and that disappointment and the shame and all of the stuff that goes along with it. It often takes quite a bit to start making that shift to where a person can focus on them without feeling victim blamed and with feeling ready. It's a stage in healing to jump right to that of, okay, got to make it about you. That completely invalidates all of the trauma and the hurt that person's experienced up to that point. Yep. Narcissists are no different. So for change to happen, a big part of that is disabling, identifying, and then disabling a person's defense mechanisms. It's quite the undertaking.
Yeah, and again, they'd have to be like willing.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. And that's its own, you know, that takes a lot of time to get a person to be able to see that clearly. And then even still doing the work necessary, in doing the work isn't just going to therapy. It's learning coping mechanisms. It's learning the differences between an empowered and a disempowered mindset, and kind of examining core beliefs, examining entitlement, learning the differences between emotionally mature and immature behavior. There's a lot to unpack. And it oftentimes takes a solid 3 to 5 years. So, you know, I'm a big fan of if a person's going to get into either individual or couples counseling, to really get clear on what are the outcomes, what would successful therapy look like, and how will you know when you're there, and in what kind of time frame are you looking at?
Yep. And the truth is, as much as you might love someone, if they're going to make you miserable, and you know that because you have proof of however many months or years prior mm-hmm. to this, you know, it's really hard for a lot of us to put ourselves first, because often we did come out of situations where we were people pleasers and we were used to putting everybody else first. Mm-hmm. But like I keep saying to everyone, we're not getting any younger. None of us, right? So mm-hmm. I really want to encourage you to think about your own happiness at some point in your life, sooner rather than later. And that's all I'll say about that. But with that, on that same note, two things from the chat. First, Sue talks about my ex-husband's an alcoholic who had quit drinking for 5 years. That's when I realized parts of his personality I blamed on alcohol were just him. I did not know about NPD then. And that's exactly what we talked about earlier. So I just wanted to point that out, because it's basically a confirmation of what we talked about, and Sue gets it. Hi, Sue. Mm-hmm. And then the other one that I wanted to address really quick was Mikey. And he says, why do people who are in narcissistic relationships resort to doing drugs? I want to talk about that. So if we're talking about a victim of a narcissist, I think we all have our own drugs of choice when we're in a situation like this. Maybe mm-hmm. it's we eat too much or whatever. That's what I did a lot of back then. And I still occasionally have my moments, but I'm doing better now. Or maybe it's we drink too much, or we shop too much. I might've done a little bit of that or whatever. Mm-hmm. Or we, you know, we do drugs, or we drink, or we shop, or we gamble, whatever it is. But I think that most people who are a victim in a toxic relationship do some kind of numbing, whatever mm-hmm. that looks like for them. Maybe they work out too much, which I would love to just get a little bit of that.
Right.
Okay. For a week or two or a month, I don't know. But anyway, but I'm just playing around. But seriously, there's always, for me, you know, sometimes we just numb out, we watch too much TV. It could be anything. But I think the reason that the victim does it is to numb whatever pain you're suffering on a day-to-day basis in that relationship. That's what I did. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that when we're talking about the narcissist, it's probably actually kind of a similar thing, but different, because we're doing it so we maybe don't explode all over someone who deserves it, or so we maybe don't, you know, we're not mean to our kids, or we're not whatever, you know, whatever our reasons are there to numb ourselves from the pain. They, I think, are also in some ways trying to numb their own pain, but maybe their pain is coming from a slightly different perspective. Like, why doesn't everybody understand how important and entitled I am? You know, mm-hmm. and we're just like, why can't you just be nice to me? It's different. You know what I mean? And I don't know, Dana, maybe you have some better, more eloquent thoughts on that than I have, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you're spot on. I mean, people, we all tend to cope in the best way we can at the time. And this is why learning different adaptive coping mechanisms is so important. So, and like Angie was saying, you know, well, this stuff's not taught. It's not taught at a young age when we need to really start learning how to cope with things. And so when a person is in a lot of pain, emotional pain, especially painful relationships, they cope in the best way they can at that time. Shopping, sex, drugs, alcohol,
sex.
I mean, you there's just all kinds of things, you name it. Yeah. Yeah. And that's part of kind of maintaining sobriety, is figuring out, okay, why was I doing what I was doing, and what are some changes that need to take place in order to kind of set myself up for success so I don't default into that. I mean, nobody, you know, decides at the age of, you know, whatever, 13, 16, oh, I can't wait to become a heroin addict.
Right.
Or, you know, ruin my life with alcohol. Nobody ever intends to lose decades
right.
to substance abuse. So, but yes, it's very common. And with abuse too, the victim or the target of that abuse is oftentimes continually blamed for it. It's look what you made me do. And it's your fault. You know, if you just did things better, I wouldn't have to yell or kick or scream or hit or threaten or whatever. And so then the victim takes all that in and they're thinking, oh my gosh, it's all my fault. I'm fundamentally flawed. I'm the problem. I just need to do better. And that's when all the walking on eggshells starts. That's when a lot of anxiety starts, depression. And then that tends to roll over because they're continually, their feelings with their mistreatment is continually being invalidated, minimized, or flat out denied. And then they're like, okay, well, then they start drinking or some sort of other way of numbing out.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Do you have a chat for us?
No, you got the one that I was going for.
Oh, right. So, okay.
Yeah.
I have one more I'd like to pick up before it might take us the whole 5 minutes. I'm not sure, but
okay.
From Suze. And she says, it's so hard to put myself first because for so many years, I've been told that I am being the selfish one. I need to stop caring what he thinks or says about me. It's so hard though. And I think we kind of touched on this earlier, and I think that's what she was responding to and about putting yourself first. It is hard. And I can completely relate to being called selfish for like wanting anything. You know, growing up, quite honestly, until I was over 30, I did not know that I deserved nice things at all, because growing up, it was you take whatever cheapest crumbs, hand-me-downs, whatever you can get, and that's all you deserve, you know? And mm-hmm. and it didn't matter if I was working for those things or whatever, it didn't matter. I should just take the least I could get, basically. And I've told this story once before. I'll tell you really quick. The first time my husband and I bought a brand new car, which by the way was nothing fancy. You know, it was a Nissan Sentra, and I'm mm-hmm. still driving it. But anyway, mm-hmm. but it's old. I just don't go that many places. It's 2011. Anyway, when I bought it, I heard through the grapevine, it had already gone no contact, but I heard it was just about a year or so at that point. And I heard through the grapevine of the family that I was being talked about because how can they afford that car? How do they afford a brand new car? Like, they didn't know my finances. They didn't know my story. They didn't know anything about my situation, but they assumed that I was doing something wrong because I bought a less than $20,000 car, you know, on payments. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Like, how can they afford that? And the point is that they tell us we're not good enough. We don't deserve nice things. We believe it. And then when we do try to do something like buy our first brand new car at over 30 years old or whatever it was, by they, you know, it's just an example of what Suze is talking about, because, you know, being told you're selfish for, you know, I mean, other people might look at it and go, well, they had three kids and they were in a position that they needed to transport the kids around in a safe vehicle. That's not selfish. It's not like we bought a fancy one, you know? So I guess my point for Suze is I feel you, and I know it's hard to get there, but you'll get there. And whatever your version of the new car is, you know what I mean? For me, I was always told, again, hand-me-downs, leftovers, cheapest, right? And, mm-hmm. and so instead of, you have to start to reprogram yourself, right? So you have to start to, whenever you catch yourself going, I don't deserve a new car or whatever your version of that is. Mm-hmm. I should just buy the cheap thing because I'm not good enough for the new thing or the whatever, you know, then you tell yourself, no, I'm just as good as everyone else. I'm just as important as everyone else. When I realized that, do you know how mad I was? Mm-hmm. That I spent so much of my life being like, oh, okay. Yep. You're better than me because you're not me. And then one day I recognized that I was just as good as you or anyone else in the world. I was mad. Did you ever get mad, Dana? I was really angry. How did I waste so much of my life? Anyway, what are your thoughts for Suze?
Yeah, it's uncomfortable, but realizing that you just as much as anybody else deserve to be your priority.
Yeah.
And this is where boundaries come into play, as well as self-esteem and self-worth of you matter, your thoughts, your feelings, your wants, your needs, all of that matters. And when we're able to balance that out, and I think it helps to kind of examine some problematic core beliefs that we have around that. If we're walking around with the idea of, putting everybody else first is I'm such a giver. I'm so caring and compassionate. And we're thinking that that's a good thing instead of actually, no, this is a very destructive thing. This is what we call martyring.
Yes, that's
so,
right.
You know, you're sacrificing yourself to keep others going. There's no benefit to that. So that's a destructive imbalance that I think a lot of us continue to set up and repeat, and then feel very bitter and jaded and frustrated and confused when the other person completely disregards us. Well, the reality is we've entered into that dynamic in that it's never been one of mutuality.
Right.
It's never been equal. It's been one of subservience. Well, I'll do everything for you. I'm the overgiver. I'll care for you indefinitely, and it'll just make my whole life about you. Well, it's a servant. Yeah. That's not a partner or a friend or anything else. There is no equality there. And so when they start actually treating us like a servant or with complete abandon and reckless disregard, then those hurt feelings surface of, well, but I should have earned a spot in your life. Like, look at how much I've done for you. So then also realizing, okay, all of this martyring behavior was actually coming with strings attached, because that was somewhere along the line we picked up that that's how we kind of earn relationships and we keep them going is through that people pleasing, ingratiating behavior, putting everybody else first and ourselves last.
And there are narcissists who play a similar game. Not that we were playing a game when we had our times like that, but I can't say that I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, I've seen it. Altruistic narcissists. Everybody thinks they're amazing, and they give and give. I have one client right now who's, I won't go into too many details, but basically her spouse continues to adopt people over and over, actually legally adopt people when she has even told the court, I cannot handle any more people. And they continue, he continues. And it's because he gets all this praise from everyone around him for doing it. But then his wife is left to pick up the mess and to literally take care of the people. And I'm just going to leave it at that. It's a horrible situation. But because everybody thinks he's such a saint, you know, altruistic narcissist. I bet you probably at least, let's see, 178 people watching right now. I bet you probably at least 50 of them can relate to that somewhere in their lives. They can see the altruistic narcissist. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But anyway, I know we are out of time, but
oh my gosh.
I know it goes so fast, doesn't it? This has been a really good one. So I just want to say this. Do you have any other questions you want to catch before we go?
No, I completely caught off guard. I thought we were only going for like 20 minutes, and I'm blown away that it's been over an hour. So
the beauty of a good conversation.
Yeah.
And again, I just want to say, I don't know what you're doing different here. Maybe it's the Canadian life. Maybe I need to move, but the glow is there, girl. It's there. Boop,
oh,
glow.
Oh, well, thank you. Well, thank
yes,
you.
Yes. Yes. All right. With all that being said, everybody, I think we're going to wrap up for today, but we will be back here. Nope. We'll be back over on Dana's channel next week, Thrive After Abuse, right here on YouTube. Huffle Mom, if you're still here, maybe you'll repeat in the chat all of our channel information, but either way, you can go to Dana's channel and subscribe, and this channel here, Angie Atkinson, and subscribe, hit the bell notification. Also hit text Angie Live, all one word, to 33222, or Dana Live, all one word, to 22999. Right?
Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And we'll send you a text before we go live each time, individually or together. All right. Yeah, I guess that's all I've got for you right now.
Okay.
All right. We'll see you next week. Dana, thank you so much. This was a good one. It did go so fast. And everybody, thank you. Oh, one last thing for you guys in the chat. If you're here now, if you have questions, comments, things you want us to talk about next week, leave them in the chat or leave them below the video when it posts officially later, and let us know what you want to know about. And we'll try to review the questions before our next session and bring them to it.
See you there. Good deal. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Dana.
Bye.
Bye-bye.